Like, I need to know more about how she went from this story that it turns out she was bamboozled and lost this like great job opportunity.
And was like, now I'm going to take down fraudsters. Fuck y'all.
Yeah. It's like, I hate all of you. And now you're all my worst enemies. And I'm going to end all of you.
I love it. What is it? Don't get mad, get even, or something like that.
If you're going to steal, steal from a bank with insurance. Which is not legal advice.
No, no, it is not.
Hi, welcome to Law School Ruined Me, the bi-weekly podcast where we explore how law school took a bunch of people and turned them into quivering balls of anxiety. Ruined a perfectly good millennial is what you did there. If you'd like to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/lawschoolruinedme, or you can listen for free and just tell all your friends how funny I am and that they should listen to me too, because validation is how I sustain myself. This week we're talking about fraud and what makes it so fascinating to a bunch of people who have actually sworn to governing legal bodies that we will super duper never do stuff like this. As you guys know, I'm T. You can find me on Tumblr at Law School Ruined Me and on Twitter at MyJDRuinedMe. And tonight I am joined by my friends Laura and Emily. Ladies, where can people find you?
Hi, I'm Laura. I am a legal aid attorney in Illinois, and you can find me on Tumblr at Tip of the Scepter, or more regularly nowadays on Twitter at Laurels413.
Hi, I'm Emily. I am also a legal aid attorney based in the Boston area. You can find me on Tumblr at Emily and the Machine, and you can find me on Instagram at EMDAYC, that's MDACY, or Twitter at MLEDAYC.
Let's start from the beginning. We're talking about fraud. We're talking about scams. What's your relationship to the topic? Like, have you been scammed? Did you write a paper on it in school? Like, what got you interested in it in the first place?
So I think I was thinking about this when you sent us the like thoughts. And I personally have not been a victim of fraud, but my grandparents were. There's actually like a twofold thing to this too, because every time my dad would ask them about it, he thought my grandpa was deflecting, because he would be like, you know, we're doing fine. It's just like Tim, and Tim is my cousin, who I probably should not have named by names, but it's fine. I am going to name and shame my cousin. So my cousin Tim, and my dad was like, yeah, he's just deflecting or whatever. And just like, remember that, because we're going to come back to that later. But there is this guy, Keith, that they swore up and down was just this like dude that was down on his luck and needed money for like his epilepsy medicine and would come and get it. And we were like, there's just something fishy about it. And by we, I mean, like, I was not super involved in this because I was 14. Mm-hmm. And then one of my cousins was a volunteer firefighter with one of the local fire departments. So he had a buddy at the police station. And this has been well over like 10 years. So I'm pretty sure he can't get in trouble for this. But he asked his buddy to run Keith, like, you know, just tell me like what you got on him.
Okay. But like, did you know who Keith was at this point?
We knew his name was Keith and people had seen him. And like my grandparents talked about Keith. Oh yeah. Keith will sometimes come by and like, you know, he'll just need some money, or he'll call us and say he's like in St. Louis and needs money for his epilepsy medicine. And it was just very strange. And then so my cousin reveals like Keith can't possibly have epilepsy because he's got this job where he's making all of like, and he has to drive for the job. And with what he is saying he has, he can't have a driver's license. Oh, and he makes up too much money because he swore he was on like Medicaid and the Medicaid issues were happening. He's like, he makes too much money for Medicaid. All these things. He's like, I have his address. I have his social security number. And we're like, okay, we don't really need that, Mark, but thanks.
He's like, I'm a cop and I will find him.
Yeah, I know. It was very intense. And 14-year-old me was just like, hell yeah. And so then we started making a plan. We're like, how are we going to get my grandparents to realize that they are being scammed by this guy? And at the time, we still didn't have like enough proof. So we're like, we need proof. So we had two plans. And the first plan was that one of my cousins and her dad, who is actually a married-in uncle, but you know, he'd been around for decades at this point, were going to go and just like talk to them. And then second plan was actually me and my cousin, the same cousin that was going to go talk to them, were going to go up to Keith's house when he said that he was in St. Louis, and we were going to knock on the door and just pretend that, like, we had like two plans. One was just that we were going to be lost, and the other one was like, I'm 14, I'm in high school, but I could still play fairly young. I'm a Girl Scout selling Girl Scout cookies. We had a plan. We were good to go. And then we ended up not having to use that plan because after my cousin and uncle went over to talk to my grandparents, my grandpa got curious because my grandpa was an engineer. And when he would get something in his head, and still to this day, when he gets something in his head, he just goes and he investigates. So he goes to the Western Union location where he had been sending all the wire transfers and said, where are the wires being retrieved from? Because Keith had been saying, wire me this money, I'm stuck in St. Louis. He was picking them up at the same damn Western Union.
Wow. That's like lazy scamming too. Like, at least go to one like down the street.
I know, extremely lazy scamming. But we did actually recently get paperwork in the mail that somebody did a class action lawsuit against Western Union because Western Union was just like letting wires go like crazy or something. I should know better because I actually read them through as the family lawyer. And I was like, yes, we should have them sign this. This is the only way they're going to get any money back, whatever. So it started with that. And then back to my cousin Tim, right? Because all this time we thought that was just grandpa deflecting. My cousin Tim, while all of this was going on, had been constantly hitting my grandparents up for money and claiming that he needed it for his college degree. And then one day after, so we get the whole Keith thing resolved. And then my dad, because he is his father's son, was like, I don't know, this whole like how much dad was talking about Tim thing just got me like thinking. So they looked at how much money he had been giving Tim. And it was insane. And they had co-signed on some of his student loans and he wasn't making any payments on them. So they were having to pay student loans. And the worst part of the story is that my mom started digging because she was pissed off. Tim never got his fucking college degree at the end of the day. That he supposedly, he would call my grandparents crying that he didn't have any money for food or for rent. And to this day, he has never once apologized to my grandparents for what he did. But yeah, so that's kind of, I think, what really got me thinking about, like, people do this. Because when you're, like, 14 years old and your grandparents are getting scammed out of, like, thousands of dollars by a stranger and then by, like, your fucking cousin.
How did they meet Keith? Like, how did he even come into their lives?
Okay, so my grandparents did not live in the best part of town. They lived, like, even when they first moved into that house back in the, like, 50s, it was not in a great area of town, and just over time it was not the best area of town. So they would regularly get people that would approach just needing money and stuff. And my grandparents were my grandma is one of those people that her heart just like goes out to people, and she's like, just, you know, give them money, like, we have money, why not? And so their house is essentially marked as a house that, like, people knew they could go get money out of, but most people would go only like once or twice, or they would even offer to do something like, we'll mow your lawn for you, or we'll help you like pick your vegetable garden.
Isn't there like, I don't want to say a homeless person, but like traveler, like people who travel from city to city, aren't there like marks that they put up identifying?
Yeah, there's like literal markings. Yeah. And I don't know if there was ever a literal one anywhere around like near the house or anything like that, but it would not surprise me if there was something. So we eventually did get them to like, my dad had this like extremely firm talk with his parents about like, it's fine that you want to give people money, but can you give like money through the like organizations, like give more money to the church, give money to St. Jude. Like, you love St. Jude, mom, just give all of your money to St. Jude. And we finally got them to stop giving random people on the street money. But yeah, so I think that that's actually, the more I think about it, I'm like, I think that's why, like, I just had this ingrained need to learn about other fraud just to figure out, like, how does this even happen? And I think that's also why, like, it makes sense to me on, like, smaller scales. I'm like, okay, yes, this totally makes sense to me how people can fall for this on a small scale, because that's what happened with my grandparents. Like, is it really that weird that they wouldn't have been cured? Like, why would my grandpa go check and see where the wires were being picked up? Because, like, I would just assume if I wired somebody a little bit of money, and it was never huge amounts of money. It was like $300, $700. It was never like, I need $10,000. So yeah, that's my fun fraud story.
It, when you started out saying it was because of your grandparents, I was expecting it was going to be one of those, like, my grandparents got a call that I was in jail stories. Like, because that was happening a lot in the late, the 20-aughts, whatever we call them.
15, are you talking about the gift card?
No. So the gift card thing is separate. I'm talking about 2008, 2009. Maybe even 2010, there was a bunch of scams. Maybe it was only happening in Canada, but like old people would get called and they would say, your granddaughter is in jail and we need $500 to bail her out. And you can do a money transfer and send it to this place and we'll pick it up. And like, it would be a person who would like pretend to be the grandchild's friend. Be like, we were out traveling in Montreal and we got arrested, kind of thing. And there was a bunch of grandparents of my friends who all got caught by the scam. Because it was in, like, the early days of Facebook, too. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't, like, it was super easy to just be like, hey, I'm going to Facebook message my grandchild and make sure that, hey, you're not in jail, right?
We, as soon as we heard about that scam, we both said to my grandparents, got like calls from my parents essentially going, if you get a call about any of your grandchildren being in jail, you hang up the phone and you call the child that is responsible for that grandchild and you check with them. And because they were convinced, like my mom's parents probably wouldn't, my grandpa would totally just be like, well, she can stay there. Not in a mean way, just more in like, if she got herself into that mess, she can get herself out. My dad's parents would have totally probably tried to figure out how to bail us out. So they were very, like, the entire family was very quickly, like, if you get a call that one of your grandchildren is in jail, they are probably not in jail. Call us and we will figure it out. Do not wire anybody any money to get them out of jail. They can survive a night in jail.
See, what's funny is when this scam was happening, it was like one of, set of the grandparents is too cash poor. So they'd be like, that's nice, and hang up. And then my other grandma, who is now passed, was business savvy enough that she would have been like, I'm going to call this grandchild crazy person who I don't know. I know T's three friends. You're not one of them.
My maternal grandfather, say in front of my cousins, he's like, Emily's my favorite grandchild. I'm like, Papa, stop. And he seems to think that because I'm a lawyer, that one, I know the laws absolutely everywhere and in every context. No, Papa, I cannot tell you the process of applying for a gun and license in Florida.
Emily, why don't you know all the laws? Like, all of, why? Didn't you pass the bar exam?
I don't know. Maybe that's why I had to take it twice, because I don't I can laugh at that. It's been 2 years. We can laugh at it now. But it is the same thing. It just seems to think that I'm rolling in money, which LOL, no. So this has me thinking of how my grandparents would react. And I think my maternal grandmother, I'd worry that she might fall for it. I could hear, totally see her being like, Ray, M's in jail. M's in jail. You need to go fly up and fix it, because they're in Tampa. And then my grandfather would be like, what? Pat, what? And probably call my mother, what the hell is going on? My paternal grandmother would probably call my mom, because she and my mom are still on great terms. Be like, Janice, is there something wrong with M? And my paternal grandfather hates me and has disowned me and probably just like hang up the phone and then just like bust some Bee Gees and start dancing in celebration.
That's great. Thanks for the call. So, before we started making fun of our dear grandparents, bless them, we're visiting the idea of what started your interest in like scamming and fraud.
I've just had a sick obsession with crime in general since I saw my first episode of SVU, which was when I was 10, by the way. But the more I speak to people who watch SVU, the more I realize they were generally pretty young when they started watching it. And my true crime fascination has largely been murder. And for a while I was listening to My Favorite Murder, and then I just started thinking, like, there has to be a more sensitive way to discuss true crime without being exploitative of the worst things that people can experience. And I actually read a Tumblr post that said, okay, for all of you people who are obsessed with true crime and murder, and you're finding that this might be a little exploitative, the people who've experienced, look into scammer content. Because by and large, people don't tend to been physically hurt. I mean, there, as we discussed earlier, there's definitely murderer scammers, which I think we should talk about. But it's also a lot more, in my opinion, psychologically fascinating. So my deep dive into, like, exclusively scammer content, honestly, versus murder, I mean, probably took off like 6 months ago. I first read a story about Anna Delvey 6 months ago, and I was fascinated. And so I've been watching a lot of almost exclusively, like, scammer documentaries and podcasts. And I backtrack. I first heard of Elizabeth Holmes like 3 years ago, and I was like, what? What? What is this? And then at the same time, my cousin, Jamie Loftus, did this. I know I talk about her a lot because I love her. Did a one-woman show called Boss Whom Is Girl, where she's, I know, isn't that great? I would spit out my wine too. And she plays a character that's parodying all those, like, toxic girl boss standards. And so she's wearing the black turtleneck and the black pants, and is speaking in a voice like this and talking about her tech startup company. And that kind of, she's going in a lot of the scammer content there. And it was just like a domino effect. So, but before I became fascinated with it, it was sort of stemmed from fear. I've always had this, probably more than normal, fear of having my identity stolen, because I've lived in 29 homes in my life. And in one of them that we lived in, my mom left a box of documents in the attic when we moved. And my social security card was in one of them, along with my original long form birth certificate. Yeah, Laura, your face is how I feel mentally.
Oh shit, in America, that's like actually bad.
It's really bad. It's really, really bad.
Like, literally everything you need to easily steal an identity forever. Sorry, I don't mean to be like, Emily, be afraid.
It all just got left there, and I don't know if it was ever taken out. The building in question was owned by my family, so I'm hoping that, and they owned it for a while after we moved there, so I'm hoping they found the box and were like, hey, take care of this.
Wait, have you never talked to your mom about this? To be like, hey, did that box get found and destroyed?
He said she doesn't know, and I try not to think about it too much.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and just compulsively check your credit score to see if any new cards have been opened?
Yeah, like twice a week. So I watched Inventing Anna, which I think we should discuss. And afterward, I watched the Firefest documentary. I was watching all of it. I have watched probably every single piece of media that's come out about Elizabeth Holmes. And I was reading online, like, good scammer content to watch. And of course it comes up, like, well, you gotta watch the OG. You have to watch Catch Me If You Can. Sure, why not? I'm going to look up to get the specific information. It's partially based on a true
story. Yes, it
is. Only a white man could get away with this. I'm just thinking that, I mean, at least with how he was portrayed, Leonardo DiCaprio, he was just, like, convincing people, like, oh yeah, you had a mistake, you know, your misunderstanding, and then just would basically just walk into places acting like he owned it. And I suppose to an extent, that's sort of what happened with Anna Delvey. But you can tell she put a lot of detail and planning into the shit that she pulled. I mean, look at Elizabeth Holmes, whereas this dude was just like, oh yeah, I feel like a man can just saunter in and just honestly more easily gaslight people to being like, yeah, I'm just meant to be here.
I think that there is an interesting component to talking about the difference between, like, a classic con artist and, like, a scam. Because when we think about, like, Catch Me If You Can, we're thinking about, like, a grifter or a con artist, like somebody who is kind of making a career out of, I am constantly engaging in minor scams. And when I think of like the explosion of our obsession with like fraud, we're more thinking about like a particular, like, I have committed to this one scam. I have committed to like Fyre Festival, like Theranos, like classic example is Enron. Like, I have committed to this one thing and praying to God it doesn't blow up on me. And like the Anna Delvey story is, yes, absolutely like a little bit of a con artist. I think the fact that it was always built on this idea that she was trying to get this loan and that was like the constant goal kind of lends itself to, it was like a singular fraud event.
That's really interesting. And I think honestly, it's hard to say. It's entirely possible that, you know, something could start off where someone has this idea and maybe it's not intending for it to be entirely fraudulent, but it turns into that. Yeah, I'm sure there was at some point a thought that Elizabeth Holmes thought that this would be possible. I think that from what I've read about her and what I understand about her background is that, you know, she grew up largely privileged. Her great-great-grandfather, I think, was the guy who came up with, like, Fleischmann's yeast. But she didn't grow up rich. She just grew up, like, well off. But knowing that she had this background, this, like, legacy, for lack of a better word, for business.
Okay, and let's also be clear here. Her parents had cash money for Stanford tuition.
That is true. Oh,
so like, well off is very much depends on how you define well off.
Okay. Yeah, you're right. I did just remember that they basically just paid for her Stanford, because I remember them being like, yeah, we'll give you your tuition money to put into Theranos. But she didn't grow up, like, she wanted to be a billionaire. You know, she didn't grow up as a billionaire. I mean, certainly she was born into money. And I think that of contributed to the entitlement that, like, oh yeah, you can definitely do that. Like a 7-year-old saying that they just want to invent something and be a billionaire, that's a weird thing to say. I mean, I've already got my younger sister and little brother that was asking me like the difference between a millionaire and a billionaire, and I think I don't have the exact number, but I looked it up and it's like, well, a million seconds is, it's a couple of days, and a billion seconds is like 31 years. And then I explained that Jeff Bezos has the ability to cure world hunger multiple times over. And my little 10-year-old brother just goes, I hate Jeff Bezos. So I both already have them hating billionaires because kids have the capacity for empathy. But her thing was like, oh, a 7-year-old saying I'm going to be a billionaire? Weird. And so her end goal was always just to be rich.
Well, like, did you even know what a billionaire was when you were 7? Because I definitely didn't.
I did not.
I had no idea.
I knew what the Babysitter's Club was.
I was really evaded by money. Put it this way. my biological father has like a gambling addiction, like a bad one. And like to the point where he would have the latex from the scratch tickets all along the, like, just on the floor of his car. And he won $1,000 on a scratch ticket when I was 7. And I remember thinking like, oh my God, we're rich now. That's how little concept I had of money. And then, honestly, it was, you know, within like less than 15 years of that, I was like, wow, $1,000 does not go a long way.
No, it was funny because, so leading up to this, so I'm a big, like, I am a true slut for a good long form article. Mm-hmm. So I had gotten most of my like fraud stories out of long form articles. But for this, I was like, I'm going to get caught up on some of those documentaries I've been missing out on. So I watched 2 Fyre Fest documentaries leading up to this, and I would really like my life back from that time.
Right?
But that man, I swear. So, and what I realized though is I was like, my overall impression, and I don't know if it's because I'm a woman or if it's like legit, but I honestly believe that like, because I also watched Inventing Anna. I did not watch the Elizabeth Holmes thing because I am too cheap to pay for HBO. My general feeling when it came to Inventing Anna and Anna Delvey is that she, I think, legitimately wanted this to happen and had herself convinced that it could happen. And there's like more thoughts I have about her entire process and who she was. I am absolutely convinced that Billy McFarland never actually thought Firefest was going to happen.
Really? I think that this played more into Emily's point on, like, if you're a moderately attractive white dude, you can walk into a room and be like, yeah, this is happening. I'm here and I've already done this. And what I always got from Firefest was that they were just like, I don't know, it's going to figure itself out.
I think his initial plan was that it was not going to happen. I think his plan was, we're going to spend this money, bring out all of these models, have this really cool thing, get people fired up about Firefest, get them interested in the app, but nobody's actually going to buy tickets. Like, nobody's actually going to go for it because this trailer we're doing for Firefest doesn't actually give them any information. And then they paid Kendall Jenner $250,000 to do an Instagram post. And that's what made it so that then they were like, oh, people actually want to do this. And then he went full on white man. Oh, we're just going to make it happen. But I think his initial idea of Firefest was not that it would actually happen that year. Maybe it would eventually happen. Probably wouldn't. But I think the entire idea was, I think in his head, we're going to do a fake music festival, get people interested in Fire, Fire Media, Fire app, let's go. I don't think they expected to actually sell as many tickets as they initially did. And then they did. And then he was like, oh, then we'll just make it happen.
Oh, shit, I guess we're doing a music festival now. And then there's that white dude attitude of like, I'm sure we can do it. It's fine.
I think it all makes sense. I guess I hadn't thought of it that way. I thought that he was like, I mean, I guess maybe this is an entirely fraud, not he was like, I'm going to get someone's money. And then if it's not, and yeah, they're not going to get what they think they're getting, but that there's still going to be like something going on. So maybe the original intent wasn't to fraud someone, but it was too like, what happens when you order a piece of clothing from one of those shady websites? You're going to get a piece of clothing in the mail, but it's not going to look like what you ordered. You know what I mean? I think that maybe that was the original thing. Like, okay, yeah.
This is going to be the AliExpress of music festivals.
It's the Cupshe and the Romwe music festival. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'm just going to put this really vague trailer together and then, you know, maybe gauge the interest when it's like, oh, man, people are interested. Like, in all reality, when you said it was $250,000 to hire Kendall Jenner, I don't think that's that much money in the long run if they realize how much interest they're going to get if they have Kendall Jenner make a Facebook post about it.
Like, if they actually had the infrastructure already ready, then it's like, yeah, it makes sense to do that. But they just did it without having anything ready for the festival.
Oh, I mean, like, the stories about, like, how are you even going to logistically do this on this island? It was very clear that, like, they hadn't thought it through very much. But, yeah, I'd always just kind of assumed that they were going to dude bro it and be like, I don't know, we'll figure it out.
I think I could see either way of their intent to defraud the attendees, but there is no question to me that they defrauded the people they hired to work for them.
Oh, 100%.
Oh my God, when I was watching the documentary about the local people that they had hired to work for them, I could have thrown something at the screen. I mean, I'm just here to reclaim the means of production by all means necessary. And then seeing that in the form of exploitation of, like, the locals on an island. It honestly kind of made me wonder if there was like some xenophobia that contributed to it to be like, okay, well, we can just take advantage of the people that work here. And I think I remember, weren't many of them traveling to and from the island for work?
Yes.
Disgusting.
Yeah. And I, like, part of it absolutely is that, like, white middle-class privilege too, of like, I don't know, I go on vacation to resorts all the time and everybody always just seems happy that we're there. And mm-hmm. and I think that that kind of attitude translated into how they treated the people who were going supposed to be doing the work at this festival. It's okay. So this leads me to two thoughts, and I'm going to diverge first to this point about the workers, is that I think that the reaction to the Firefest documentaries and like when it was coming out and everybody on Twitter was trying to like run fundraisers for some of these workers, it showed us that when we consume these types of stories, we don't give a fuck about the rich people who paid $250,000 to go to this island and wound up camping. But because it's fun to laugh at rich people. Like, that's just some schadenfreude in that. But we don't like seeing people of our own social class or lower being essentially defrauded. It's to enjoy fraud media, to enjoy scam content, it's got to be punching above my weight class.
There's definitely some truth to that. I would say, so for example, with Anna Delvey, she was not found guilty of defrauding her friend, Rachel Deloche Williams. And, you know, it could be because before I watched Inventing Anna, before it came out, I was just so desperate to find content for it that I was reading everything I could. And I ended up reading the ebook called My Friend Anna that was written by Rachel Deloche Williams. And granted, I don't know a whole lot about the background she came from. It sounded like she grew up not rich, but, you know, upper middle class, and was in a position where she, you know, almost lost her job and almost had to, you know, she was at serious risk because of having these charges on her account. I felt for her because she was a normal person who was impacted, granted someone who was, you know, quite privileged. And I was like, really, you know, of course it's the banks that were the ones who she was found guilty of frauding. Or with Elizabeth Holmes, she didn't face any repercussions in her fraud charges for the people who were getting these misleading blood tests. Someone was falsely diagnosed with HIV. A woman who had a history of miscarriages was told that she had miscarried again when in fact she had not. Her doctor was about to like schedule DNC until they did one non-Theranos test that showed, oh wait, you're actually still pregnant. People's lives were effectively ruined by that. And yeah, it's not as if I think it was right that people were defrauding banks, because certainly it's not. It creates a problem that's going to contribute to the systemic lack of economic access for non-rich people who aren't scammers. Like, for example, as if it isn't already, you know, difficult enough to get loans, especially, you know, for people of color. But now, one of the things that they mentioned in that Hulu show, and, you know, this has a whole lot to do with just, you know, women being stereotyped and like put under one sort of umbrella, but now it's creating even more of a stigma about women entrepreneurs, and to the point where, you know, one, I think she was a CEO, was told, you know, you should cut your hair dye your hair because you look like Elizabeth Holmes.
Isn't that like such bullshit too? Because like for all of these years, we know that men have been running fraud schemes. Like some of the biggest fraud schemes have been run by men, and they're like, as soon as like a couple women, and like plenty of women have had totally legit entrepreneurial endeavors that have done amazing things. And then you get like a couple of women that have like these really out there stories. And I mean, that was even a big part of like the Inventing Anna storyline, is that it could have ended up being a non-story. Like that was the whole, and I know part of that was like Inventing Anna was not a 100% true to facts like documentary of the entire story, but the entire idea was it almost just kind of would have slid under the radar. Like there was an objectively like smaller newspaper that picked up the story at first, and then her friend Rachel did do like, she sold a writing to Vanity Fair, about it. And even then, there wasn't a ton in there that wasn't just more about her own experience with Anna, but nothing that really would have gotten people. They would have just been like, wow, that's kind of weird, but it never would have blown up if there hadn't been the huge New York article about it, if there hadn't been then eventual other like information out there about it. And so then that's what like, and so then it's, oh, since now we have like two whole big women's fraud stories. Now we're all going to look at women entrepreneurs, even with a like bigger stink eye, because clearly they are all out to be scammers because it was so easily done, even though it clearly like wasn't easily done. Like that, I think, is what drives me nuts about it, is I'm like, in like the Anna Delvey story, just, I mean, she did put a ton, like it was not easy for her to do everything. She had to come across, I legitimately do think that she was a very, like, it was, I'm acting like she's dead, she's still alive, but that she is a legitimately very smart person, because she wouldn't have been able to do some of what she did without having the ability, like, just the knowledge to do it.
Oh yeah, like the, okay, so there's some funny things about the Anna Delvey story, though, because there's things like, this is how easy technology has made it to fake documents, because you can use like Adobe and Microsoft Word and create fake trust deeds, apparently. And you can just set up a new email and send fake emails to the bank. And like, technology has made a lot of this very accessible and very easy if you have the technological competency to do it. But a really good grifter will play into the emotions of the people around them, and they have to have enough, I don't know if emotional intelligence is the right word, but they have to have enough of a understanding of the emotions of the people around them to be able to twist everything to their benefit.
I was going to say social finesse. I mean, I'm so fascinated by this, and I've listened to like multiple podcasts and read letters that Anna has written while in jail. One as recently as, I think like 3 weeks ago, no, a little more than a month ago, she was in ICE detention. I haven't checked it in a couple weeks, but last I heard that she was scheduled to be deported back to Germany and just didn't get on the plane and hadn't been found since then. I'm going to look that up. But she,
a little iconic.
I mean, honestly, yes. And, you know, she's admitted, she said, I would say I'm sorry, but I'm not a good person. And then hearing the way that she was speaking to this interviewer, you know, denying that there was really anything that had been done wrong. A point that she made that kind of fascinated me was, well, if they're trying to, you know, no one can prove that I'm not actually rich. She said they, you know, they could just give me bail and then I could prove that I was rich and they won't do it.
It's just, I laugh because I remember reading the original article when it came out, because it was like circulating on Twitter, and like the professionals on Twitter who like do fraud stuff, we gobbled it up. And I remember watching Inventing Anna and seeing the way that it was played, that there was a part of her who genuinely believed that there is some sort of secret German heiress money there. And the, I mean, maybe part of it is that to be a good grifter, to be a good con man, you have to believe your own con.
Oh, yeah.
And as sociopaths often are, I think she just had an inflated view of herself because she looked down on people. But the intelligence that she had was, even though it didn't seem like she had the means to understand why the people that she was defrauding were negatively impacted, she was able to connect to them and use them to her advantage. So many fraudsters are suspected to be sociopaths and psychopaths. There was, I think, like some psychologist, I don't remember a specific name, I'll try to find it, who grew up as a family friend of Elizabeth Holmes and had said that one of the signs of someone doing something to alter, not necessarily just their appearance, but the way they're presented, like changing their voice, can be considered a hallmark of psychopathy. I think you kind of need to lack scruples to be able to go on with using people like that.
Right, like, because if you think about it, and again, I'm thinking about, like, Anna Delvey, like, some of her early stuff that she was doing when it was just more, like, oh, she was making friends, and, like, her boyfriend kept paying for everything, and there was a time that, like, oh, there's, like, the hotel charge didn't work or whatever. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like, she wasn't doing anything too major, and, like, even, like, some of the hotel bills and things like that. And then there's the trip to Morocco with Rachel. And it's so funny because on one hand, I can 100% see how Anna did not end up convicted of fraud for what she did to Rachel, because I think that it is questionable if it was really a fraudulent thing, like an illegal. So, like, this is, you know, lawyer hat on, like, yeah, I yes. could, I think it's very, I think you could easily convince a jury that that wasn't truly fraud, especially when there's all these other things that you can point to. But Anna had to know going into Morocco that she did not actually have the ability to pay for this trip. And she still went.
Well, and I mean, so there's an interesting thing about a lot of cons is that they all end up flying too close to the sun. Right? Like, with Fyre Festival, guys, if you had, like, six people buy tickets and you weren't intending to put on that concert, you're like, oh, we actually, like, make up some bullshit excuse, and while you're not holding it, you refund a couple of those tickets and away you go. With when you have all of these people buy in, suddenly you're committed and you're like, okay, I guess we have to do this. And with the way that Anna's scam had been built, was it was built on this idea of presenting a certain amount of luxury and buying into the idea that eventually all of this is going to pay off. And I think that there was a certain amount of, I have to keep going, I have to keep being in these hotels. Because she could have gone and defrauded a Motel 6, but she didn't. She wanted, she needed.
Sorry, I actually kind of question if she could have. Because
do you think the Motel 6 has got better security?
I don't think the Motel 6 would have let her in the door without having a card on hand that was accepted. All these other hotels, rich people all the time have weird, like, I never under, when they were like, oh, rich people all the time have issues with their cards, I'm like, what the hell? Like, I am not a rich person. And I, like, I almost cried. I woke up the other morning and it was like my car insurance payment was declined. And I was like, what the fuck? And it's because I had an old credit card number before my wallet got lost or stolen. So it was fine. But I was like, that just doesn't really happen to me because I am so, like, but it, like, they just, all the rich people apparently just have issues with their cards all the time, which I do not understand. And so the hotels are just used to it, or they know, like, oh, they've got money, so it'll be fine. Or they say, like, oh, I'll send a wire. And, like, they just know it's not going to be an issue because they're a known person. Like, it's the whole thing that, like, in the movie, in the documentary, Neff was like, well, I put her on our list. And so everybody knew she was good for the money. Mm-hmm. So I honestly think that if Anna had been trying to, like, hang out at the Motel 6 or the Best Western, she would have never gotten a room. And I think that's why she wasn't able to get a room anywhere when things were in the worst of the worst, because none of the big hotels would take her anymore. And she knew she couldn't get a room at, like, a cheap, like, she couldn't even get a bed at a cheap hotel because she had nothing to give them.
An inherent distrust of poor people.
If you're coming in here, you must obviously, like, be able to afford it. And so therefore we are going to trust you because you look the right way and you talk the right way and you dress and act the right way. But this, so mentioning Rachel again, something had popped into my head when Emily had said before that, like, she almost lost her job and she almost had these bad things happen to her. And I think that this is something that maybe people who aren't lawyers won't necessarily get about some of these fraud stories, is that when we get to the trial stage, like, we are no longer consuming an interesting Vanity Fair article or a New Yorker article. Now we are talking about the civil or criminal justice system and those burdens of proof, and also double recovery. And if we're talking about somebody who had almost bad things happen to them, and this, I almost lost my job, and I almost had bad things happen in my life, yeah. That's not necessarily criminal. Like, you almost had bad things happen, sure. But also, you have now financially benefited from this more than what you almost lost. And Amex wrote it off because they have insurance. And this is where we come into why I think we enjoy some of these stories, is because nobody gives a fuck when you defraud the bank, because they paid for insurance and they haven't actually lost anything. Like, when they were doing the Inventing Anna story, there was a couple throwaway lines about they're pretty sure that there are other places that had given her money that just never reported it, because to admit that they had been duped by this 25-year-old girl would have been worse than just quietly filing the claim to their insurance and recovering.
Yeah, you're right. You know, may as well take the L to preserve your reputation. That's a good point.
And so, like, yes, the manipulation that happened in Morocco was a terrible thing. You shouldn't do that to somebody. You shouldn't be like, hey, can you take your company credit card and pay for the $60,000 trip we've taken? That's a shitty thing to do. But also, and I don't know if it's the way that she views herself, I don't know if it's partially the way that the actress portrayed her in Inventing Anna, but I've read that Vanity Fair article. Rachel does not come across as a sympathetic person.
She really, and that was why I think it was one of those, like, I felt for Rachel because I can see where that would be very stressful, but it is a little bit like, and I think that's where it gets worse sometimes. And it's the same thing when it comes to things like the Tindler Swindler and things like that, where it's just so far removed from a situation I would ever put myself into, because I don't care how, like, good of a friend I think a friend is, I am not going to sit there and essentially, like, say, oh, let's go to Morocco. And, like, you, like, I would never, I know, I think I would have to be, like, literally married to somebody before I would go on a vacation that I was not sure that I could personally pay for all aspects of my side of the trip, no matter how generous of a friend this friend seemed like they were, especially not to a country that I did not feel like was going to be friendly to me as somebody from the United States. Like, okay, we're going to, like, Canada. I don't think the Canadians would be, like, particularly horrific to me. Like, okay, yeah, like, you know, US is not necessarily the best place in the world to most places right now, but it's not somewhere where we have, like, a super testy situation going on.
You'd be Canadian passing in Canada because you're white.
Exactly. And I mean, that's what, like, you know, there's, like, different countries that I would probably have a different, like, level of, this is probably okay, or it probably will not be that hard for me to get to, like, an embassy that can help me out if there's a problem, or contact an embassy that can help me out if there's a problem. Like, I know that there are relationships between my country and this country that if something goes wrong, like, somebody will make sure I can get back to the United States. When Rachel is, like, having to call American Express and essentially they're like, okay, how much money do we need to approve to get you out of Morocco? Which is great, good on American Express, but I'm like, it's just so far removed from a situation that I would ever put myself into, that, like, while I can, like, I feel for her because I'm sure it was an incredibly stressful situation, at the same time, I'm like, you had a little bit of Anna in you yourself, of somebody who was partying with people that were above your level and you wanted desperately to be in that class. And I think that's probably part of why it hit Rachel so bad, is that, like, there's a level there.
If Anna's a fake, I'm a fake.
Yeah. And I'm not saying, you're like, again, I still, like, I really do feel for, like, I cannot imagine what it would be like to think that your friend was good for this money, that you were like, okay, I can put this on my card to get us out of here, but I'm really getting you to cover this. And her saying, like, yeah, no, I'll get it to you. I cannot imagine the level of stress that would be. And part of that, I think, is also because, like I said, I would literally never put myself in that situation. But I do think there's something there of, there's a level there of, Rachel was doing the exact same thing, not scamming other people necessarily, but almost like Anna was to Rachel what Rachel's first boyfriend was, like the futurist in Ventana. He was Chase, right? They never actually identified the actual boyfriend and most of the other things, but that's essentially like who. And I mean, same thing too, because like the futurist boyfriend, like it turns out he didn't have all of the like money that he said. Sorry, this is all stuff I'm realizing, like as I'm talking it out, I'm like, I think that's where it really comes down to, is that Rachel is treating Anna like Anna had been treating her boyfriend.
Yeah. And I think that there's like almost a cycle of it too, of like needing to live the same life that your friends and your social circle are living. And I think part of why we latch on to Anna and she's sort of like a folk icon is because the service staff talk about how she tipped them well. And so she never screwed over service staff. And because we don't have that Fyre Festival comparison over like, he's an asshole and they fucked over this whole island, we're like, he was treating the workers of New York really well, and it's mostly just rich people who got caught up in this idea that she looks and acts like me and so therefore must be like me.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there were one occasion that Anna was arrested for dining and dashing. But it is true, by and large, he did treat people well, or that treat service staff well. And when Laura really has me thinking about something that Sam and I were kind of arguing about while we were watching Inventing Anna. Sam was saying, well, you just shouldn't expect anything for free like this. And I said, I do agree with that, but I also can understand how she sort of thought that because of the lifestyle that Anna was living. But something else occurred to me, which is Rachel mentions in her book that she makes that the $60,000 that she owed was more than she made in a year. And she was working in Vanity Fair. She was living, I don't know which borough she was in, but you know, New York City is very expensive. And clearly meeting celebrities and people of means a lot. So I can understand if one might feel pressured to want to conform to that lifestyle.
Oh yeah. And I can imagine like if you're like a junior staffer at Vanity Fair, you cannot afford the clothes that is sort of expected of somebody at Vanity Fair, meeting these people, going to these events, and to then have some sort of like financial hookup that you can kind of abuse a little bit and you're paying for with your time. Like, she was basically a sugar baby, and like, power to her.
And I think I was reading this book and I'm a bleeding heart. That's just who I am. And I was imagining just being in that hotel and having been like, we need a card right now. I mean, like, oh my God, am I going to go to jail? Am I going to go to jail? What the hell is going to happen? I can't say I wouldn't do that. I certainly wouldn't do the same thing. I can't say that I certainly would, but I cannot honestly say that I wouldn't. I just don't know. I don't think I would assume, though, that if that happened, that I would get the money back. I'd be like, okay, what's going to be worse in the long run? Potentially getting arrested here and like, getting in serious trouble in a foreign country, or maxing out this credit card and then potentially handling that debt when I get back. Because I mean, also I'm a lawyer. She probably didn't have this perspective, but at least I know, I'm like, there really isn't, there's no debtor's prison in the United States. So I see both sides of it. And yeah, I'm definitely guilty of like having my emotions kind of impact that. But yeah, I was upset that she wasn't convicted of defrauding Rachel, but I also completely understand why. I think I could have made the argument either way, but I totally get why it happened.
It's like, it's such a lawyer thing too. It's like, I could have argued either side of that pretty easily. But also part of that is like, the actress who plays Rachel in Inventing Anna, Katie Lowes, is fantastic at making you either love her or hate her, depending on what you need from her in a certain scene. So like, she was a perfect casting choice for that.
Yes.
She was an excellent casting choice.
This comes to something that Laura had said earlier, that like, I think I can tie into the Dropout a little bit too. Was that you were mentioning how like rich people will be like, my card's not working here, so I'm just going to wire you money. One of the things that I was truly fascinated about when the Inventing Anna story dropped originally, like the New Yorker article, before they got picked up by Netflix and before the trial and all of these things, was the details in the article about the wire fraud she was perpetuating. And the actual, like, technical acumen that would have to go into that. And it's, that's the kind of scams that, like, truly fascinate me. The Bad Blood book that I think it was John Carreyrou wrote.
And if you haven't listened to Bad Blood, the final chapter, the podcast, okay, so good, so good. But yes, I've been meaning to read Bad Blood.
So I listened to it on an audiobook, and it was just like crocheting Christmas presents as I listened to it. And he really goes into, in the book, some of the technical stuff that was going on and some of the, like, absolutely fucked up technical mayhem that they were creating to fraudulently create these blood tests. Like, the thing about inventing Anna, the thing about the dropout, is that they skim right over it. They're like, yeah, there's this machine. It doesn't actually work. There was this other guy that we brought in that we did have a fantastic line in one of the episodes. Stephen Fry is like, this isn't microfluidics anymore. And I wanted so much more of that, because that's the really fun story about Theranos. Is, yes, in the trial and, like, the Dropout podcast doesn't cover any of this either. It's, and I understand, because it's not interesting to anybody but me. the trial details that we got on the Dropout podcast did not go into some of the technical stuff. But what was really interesting was that she started out with this idea that we are going to use microfluidics to do blood tests, in kind of the same way that you think about Anna Delvey starting out of, like, I am going to go work in the fashion industry, and maybe I'm actually secretly a German heiress. Who knows? This is the story I've told myself. And Elizabeth Holmes goes in with this idea that I am brilliant. I come from a medical and science background from my family, because apparently that's passed down by genetics. And I'm going to invent this thing with microfluidics. And the beginning of the Dropout does show her taking to the professor several ideas that the professor is like, this will not work because physics. And during John Carreyrou's book, he talks about how they realized that the microfluidics weren't working and went to modifying existing technology to try to make it work with diluted blood samples.
Which is not even really blood anymore.
No, and it's the technical side of, like, the pipettes were breaking and we were trying to run, like, 50 tests in this and the assays kept mixing with each other, and, like, just the actual mechanics of what was happening within those devices and how absolutely fucked up it was is it's a catnip to me.
I definitely need to read that. No, I do love stuff like that, mostly because I'm really fascinated by chemistry and biology in that sense, and I'm also mind blown by it because I don't know shit about fuck. So that's another, I don't know, I love stuff like that.
It makes me feel smart.
Yeah.
But, like, the technical side of, like, there is no way that Elizabeth Holmes didn't make conscious decisions about some of these technical changes in the device and how the actual operations of, like, the Edison 2.0 were working.
There's no way. You're right.
And you had to have known that you were going from a microfluidics idea to, this is definitely not microfluidics. You've made a decision to do that. And the way that you have decided to hide all of this information, in the same way that you, like, hide a bunch of information when you craft a fucking wire fraud, it's just, it's stuff that I guess they don't think that the average viewer is going to find as interesting as, look at all of these pretty dresses that she bought while she was shopping.
You know what's really funny too is inventing Anna just, like, really, really, really glossed over that she started cashing bad checks, mm-hmm. like at the very tail end before she got arrested. And I found that fascinating because that's almost a step down from what she had been doing. I mean, she'd been doing, like, huge fraud and scamming, like, companies to give her giant sums of money. And she got, like, this bank, like, she and, like, Alan, the attorney who somehow mm-hmm. ended up promoted at the end of the day, because white men can do no wrong.
Leave it to a white dude to fall up.
You know, like, I don't know, but I kind of really hope it's true that he lost his VIP racquetball court. Like, I hope that part wasn't made up. I feel like it probably was, but I hope that part's true. But it's just the fact that she went from, like, you know, and that's where she was getting some of her money. Like, when she actually had money, it was like from those big views. And then at the end, when she's like desperate and she knows everything is falling apart, and that's when she starts doing the stuff that is probably more than anything what really got her in the most amount of trouble, like that, because it's so easy to track a bad check. Mm-hmm. And it's such an intentional thing. And like, it's so easy to track that she knew that the money wasn't there and like all of this, all of these things. And I'm like, she was really falling. Like, she knew at that point, like that's when she knew that things were falling apart and she was clinging to the last bit of what she could do.
So that's what really captures my attention in a fraud story, is those like absolutely batshit technical details. What about you guys?
I think a big part of it is trying to get into the psychological aspect of it. And I think what you're saying, Laura, about how in the end she was just cashing those bad checks, which, yeah, kind of was a step down from what she was doing. I think it's a sign to me that, like, I'm in too deep. What more can I do? And I've heard that when Elizabeth Holmes was able to tell that, like, Theranos was going under, she got a Siberian husky puppy, which, I mean, if you're experiencing, I mean, that's one way to try to cope with the anxiety of it. And then when she was actually facing charges, she was like going to Burning Man and doing all these things with her boyfriend. It's like, it's kind of hit you like, oh shit, I failed. And to add upon to the psychological aspect of it, I don't think that it's black or white. I don't think that, you know, someone woke up and, or in that it's always that someone wakes up and it's like, you know what, I'm going to do this thing and I'm going to defraud people for millions. I do think that Anna Delvey thought that opening this club and getting this loan would be possible, but I think she underestimated the process that would need to go into that. I think she had an overinflated view of her own capability, and I think she lacked the scruples to find the way to go about doing it the right way. I think that Elizabeth Holmes, being born into massive privilege and was taught that there was, like, business acumen in her blood, inflated her opinion of her own ability and her own capability. I mean, even I kind of fell for it. I didn't really, it took me a while. What I mean by I fell for it is that when I was hearing all about Theranos, it's like, okay, yeah, clearly she's someone with a background in STEM. I mean, yeah, she did like a year of microfluidics at Stanford. There's no question she's very intelligent. That does not give you the skills to be able to establish this whole new system. And I don't think that, I'm like, okay, even if you accept that you don't have the skill to do that, and then you go about hiring people who do have the skill, that doesn't mean that you're off the hook for when even they can't make it physically possible. So I do think there was at some point where they were like, okay, well, I guess I need to, I'm too in too deep now, I need to make it work. I would say, based off of what I've read, that for Elizabeth Holmes, that was when they faked the demonstration, I want to say, in Switzerland, where they played that recording of, like, one successful test that they've had. Like, all right, I mean, if we don't show this, we're going under. I can't say specifically when that was for Anna, but I'm sure she hit it. But I would, you know, I wouldn't say that they were just like, yeah, I'm going to defraud a bunch of people. I could more confidently say that maybe about Bernie Madoff.
I bet you anything with Anna, it was probably when the money with the boyfriend started to run out.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because, like, before that, she's in, like, the fashion scene with the internship. Like, you can still be involved in the scene and, like, be telling the lie that you're secretly a German heiress without trying to get millions of dollars from the bank. And then you have a boyfriend who's paying for lots of stuff, and you can continue to live the lifestyle.
Yeah, I think when, like, the money, essentially that access to money ran out, and she realized, like, oh, I really do need this, like, when it, and not even when it ran out, like, when she just started to realize that things were starting to fall apart a little bit with him, and then when for sure it was gone, and then she realized, if I want to do anything, I have to find my own money. And I think, kind of going back to what you were saying, Emily, of, like, I think if Anna had been willing, and this, I hate this like whole line of like, just put in the work and you'll like pull yourself, like, but it's one of those things where I think if she had been okay with taking a little bit more time, I don't know that she would have been able to make the club she was thinking of, but I do think she could have done something like really cool in New York. Like if she had just put in some of the like sweat equity it would take, instead of she surrounded herself with all these people that did have money, or that it did seem like just had so much access to things. And maybe she didn't realize that, like, her, was it the guy's name was like Val or something like that, that was like the other dude that was like besties with the rich lady. And he clearly was not like actually living a great life, like didn't have a ton of money or whatever, but he was still like, and he was putting in work and things like that. And I just think she didn't feel like she should have to do that necessarily, because other people she was hanging out with, she didn't see them doing that.
Yeah, it's interesting because there was definitely like this sense of entitlement that came across in the Inventing Anna story of, you could have, like, there's a massive amount of work that goes into perpetuating that type of scam. And you absolutely could have invested that same level of energy into something a little bit less illegal.
Has made me wonder, thinking the same thing, because they're unquestionably people who are smart and creative. And it makes me think, and like, Sam and I see very much the same way on, you know, our views on reclaiming, seizing the means of production. And Sam's like, well, of course I don't feel for them. Every banker on earth is a psychopath. And kind of made me think, like, how many people like Anna and like Elizabeth are actually working for the banks and doing these things legally? And then it also makes me think, well, you know what you had mentioned about her attorney with the racquetball? I want to know how many people with these same predispositions toward having skill for fraud, how many of them are lawyers?
Oh, there's got to be like so many.
Are we going to go to school?